Committee on Human Resources and go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 554, and we'll have staff to introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 554 requires the Department of Human Services to mail a notice of intended action regarding general assistance or public assistance at least 20 days before the date of the action, and that is the printed bill. However, you have two amendments. The -2 amendment would change 20 days to 30 days prior to that action, and you have the -3 amendment that Senator Walker is here to explain.
All right, go ahead, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. I have to go next door and hear all about building codes this afternoon, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Lucky you.
Yeah. My name is Vicki Walker. I'm State Senator in District 7, and I brought Senate Bill 554 to you because I was a little upset after the ballot measure 28 failed, but prior to that, when we were implementing the changes from the special session where we're cutting programs and cutting people off of programs, I felt we were getting lots of phone calls saying that they just got the notice. It wasn't sufficient time to try to find alternative places to get their medications and things of that nature. So I called the department to find out why the notice was so short, and I was told by the department that federal law requires states to give a minimum of 10 days notice when they're cutting programs. That's a minimum of 10 days notice, but the states can go beyond that. So I went to 20, and then I had the department, actually the director was in my office, and Lisa Joyce, and they told me, well, we need 28 days because of February. So I fussed about that, and we had it changed to 28. Then I understand you, Mr. Chair, wanted it 30. So I actually had Jerry Fuller from the department come into my office on Monday and speak to me about this, and apparently 28 and 30 doesn't really matter. What really matters is that the department gets sufficient notice from this legislature about when we're going to cut programs so that they can give adequate notice. Now, the way the bill was originally drafted, and that's what you'll see in the -3 amendments, they are a bit different. The bill as originally drafted was department-wide, unbeknownst to me. I just asked LC to draft the bill, and I didn't think about it, but it would have had a huge fiscal impact, and as was explain to me, and they will explain to you, we could have people who are no longer eligible for state programs move from the state or get a job that keeps them or insurance that doesn't make them eligible for these programs. With 30 days notice for those folks, that would mean they'd be on the state budget for another 30 days, even though they were no longer eligible. So we limited this amendment to benefit programs, and I'll have the department explain to you a little bit more about that, but we're just narrowing it down to just those people who get general assistance and public assistance from the state government. We are giving them 30 days notice. However, the department says they need 60 days to effectively do that. So in sub 2 on line 11 of the -3 amendments, you'll see that if the department has fewer than 60 days before the effective date to implement a proposed change, then they can give a minimum of 10 days notice. I'll let them explain why they need that. And I think one of those issues goes to the fact that the emergency board actually told the department, is my understanding, not to give people notice early on because they didn't want people to panic. I feel that that was really inappropriate advice and counsel by the emergency board because it would have given people a couple of months to actually search for alternative sources to be to get their medications and to be getting services. So I was quite disappointed, and that's why this whole bill came about. We have in the -3 amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have inserted an emergency clause that makes this effective July 1 so that it corresponds with the new budget year, so that when we come out with our budget and we're whacking away at programs again, this becomes effective immediately on July 1. So I thought that was a good amendment. With that, I really have nothing else to add. The department can explain all of what I just tried to tell you, probably more coherently than I. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
All right.
Questions? You've done an admirable job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you haven't lost the bill yet.
Well, just make sure I carry this one, Mr. Chair, so I can keep my my count up. I understand there is a movement afoot to try to unseat my current record of 21.
So I
appreciate your input, Mr. Chair, on getting that up to 30 days, and appreciate the attention of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have Elizabeth Lopez and Michael Buckley. I'm not sure who goes first, but I won't enter into those domestic battles. I'll let you guys in.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley, and I was going to present the basic testimony. Elizabeth is here and available should we get into some further questions that she might be able to help on.
All right.
Specifically as it relates to adult programs. Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley, and I'm the acting administrator for self-sufficiency and child safety in the Department of Human Services. And we're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 554 in its amended form, -3 amendments. Basically, what this bill does, I think that's pretty much already been explained, but in a nutshell, what it will do is when the department makes mass program changes that results in a reduction of benefits for large numbers of individuals, we will be required to issue a notice of reduction 30 days prior to the actual effective date of those reductions. And then in situations where we've been given less than 60 days to effect the notice, we will issue a notice as soon as possible, but no later than the federally required 10-day notice. I think the distinction here is when grants are reduced due to mass program changes or whether it's due to a change in individual eligibility, and that's really the distinction here. When an individual's eligibility for benefits changes as a result of something in their household, either income or household composition, when that changes, we are required to issue a formal notice of either reduction or termination of benefits. And those individual notices really aren't affected by this proposed legislation. It's when we are going to do a mass program reduction, like an example would be the temporary assistance to needy families, when we're going to do a rateable reduction or a $5 reduction across the board, that would be considered a mass change. Or if we're going to terminate an entire program, that would be considered a mass change.
Mr. Buckley, are you referring to the -3 amendments?
Yes.
In your
Chairman Fisher, yes.
Or the original bill?
Chairman Fisher, we're referring specifically to the -3 amendments.
Okay.
That's what we're testifying on.
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that because it's difficult sometimes for those of us that don't have too much legal training to try to read and figure all these things out. So I wanted to make sure in my own mind that we were looking at the -3 amendments as a
effect. That's correct.
54.
That's correct.
Thank you. I apologize for the interruption.
No. Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, in a nutshell, that's really what this bill does. The department can certainly implement this without very much difficulty, and so therefore we're in support of the bill. I think at that completes my testimony, unless you have questions.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
As a matter of fairness, you obviously aren't interested in paying somebody benefits if they move out of town.
That's correct.
and I don't blame them. Ironically, as a private or nonprofit business, I would think that I would have the same reasonable expectation of not having to pay somebody that's no longer. In a way, I contracted with me or something. But you send out notices to the private and nonprofit sector of a termination, then right along with that you say, we're terminating the program on a certain date, but you got to wait until they don't pay their bill and then wait 30 days for the notice. So you're saying on the one hand, you don't want to pay for people that are moving out of state and maybe no longer qualify for things, but you're very happily in the saddle when it comes to causing the private and nonprofit people to pay for not 30 days, but potentially 60 days. And then not even maybe leaving them with the way their patients are. Their residents aren't moving out of state. They haven't gone somewhere else where they're getting some other kind of services.
It's better with it.
Chairman Fisher, I'm not sure I'm fully grasping your comment.
Well, I'll put it to you very plainly.
Okay.
People in the care giving arena, private and nonprofit individuals, had their residents notified that they would no longer, after a certain date, which was less than 30 days, be able to receive help from the agency in certain categories. At the same time, letters went out telling those proprietors of those businesses, both private and nonprofit, that they could not immediately terminate those people and ask them to leave, that they must wait until their bill had not been paid before they could initiate a notice, a 30-day notice of non-payment and eviction. So ultimately, if it came on the right date, that would allow them potentially 60 days to go without paying their bill. It could even be more than that because, generally speaking, if you bill them at the end of 30 days, you give them a few days to get that payment in before they're delinquent. So therefore, it might even run more longer than that. It could be as much as two and a half months that you would be in the process of eating their care, and yet you're not willing to basically go one day of paying over what you need to pay or what by law you need to pay. And I feel that this is totally unfair. If you expect us to do that, you ought to cover those days and say, okay, fine, we are going to pay up to that point in time, and you must make arrangements to. That's bad enough. But just to be summarily told that, no, you can pay up to and take care of somebody free up to potential of 60 to 70 days, to me, is not any way close to being a fair, equal situation. And that's one reason I insisted on the 30 days, because it didn't make any difference to me with 28 days in February. You didn't give us that option. And so, you know, it would seem to me that you could issue something on the 29th day of January on that 1 month so that you met the 30-day standard. It's just as easy as you could do it by the second or the first day of a month to give them 30 days on a 31-day month. And, you know, I'm not interested in running the state anymore. I mean, what I'm trying to do is get a situation whereby we're dealing on as close as we can to the same principles between government and what you're requiring of business. And that's where I'm coming from with my 30-day amendment. Now, I understand a situation whereby somebody would move out of state and not tell you, or somebody would get an increase and have to work on that. And I'm perfectly willing to work on those bases with that, some way that we can do it. Again, there was nothing in the notification that we received that said anything about if you're a big organization and you can't get all your work done within that 60 days, that you can only give 10 days notice or anything like this, we're expected automatically to live within the law regardless of any situation that we might have. I don't think that our long-term care people hire extra staff just to be able to all of a sudden answer a hurry-up need or something like that from the state government. I don't think that you would allow us to receive payments on that basis. So I am a bit indifferent to special treatment here. You know, we deal with emergencies as we need to deal with emergencies. And if we had an emergency like that or something, I'd be expected to have my people work around the clock or all night long or something in order to get it done. Now, that brings us to the point of how do we answer the problem so somehow we have a reasonable fairness to people. And I'll grant you that most of our businesses are not big enough that notification, you know, to 150 or less people is probably that big of a hassle, but...
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Lopez, and I am the administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits. We're part of the Department of Human Services serving seniors and people with disabilities, and very clearly want to acknowledge the conflict in our discharge and eviction laws with the program policy, program ending laws. What we believe this bill addresses is our requirement to give individuals 30 days notice of programs ending, and we certainly are in support of doing that where we are notified that this is a change that is going to happen. The difficulty that you have in trying to turn a large system on a dime is that even when we have individuals running around the clock, which we often do, our computer systems can only do so much. And in some cases, when you're sending out mass notices, multiple thousands of notices, we need that time to make sure we identify the appropriate folks that should be receiving notices.
Well, I I'm not in disagreement with this. I'm only saying these are things that we relate to much when we see a constant effort of government to protect its tail, but not anyways near as the concerns, because I don't see you bringing up here and saying, now we're not dealing fair with the folks in long-term care business under this process, so would you please allow them to have a few days less if we have to close a program down? You see, on the one hand, you're asking only for yourself and your benefit. You're not supporting and asking for some help over here on the other side. And again, I have there's the thing that I see is it's not just us trying to protect our business. It's just not us trying to protect our state. It is us dealing fairly with the clients that have been removed from their homes because they can no longer stay there. Most of the time, their homes have either been sold or rented or taken over to pay for past support that's been given them. They have nowhere to go. It is not easy to place those folks. And for a department to summarily say, you know, things are ending here without then again making any effort, I don't see again here we're just going to quit paying at a certain date, but you're responsible for another date. And what do you do if they don't have a place to go? Do you honestly anticipate that a long-term care facility is going to take one of those folks and put them in the street without their gown because maybe they don't even own any clothes anymore because they can't use them? I don't see this happening. And so the state is the one that made the contract with the person to take care of these folks. It's now the state saying, oh, all of a sudden I'm not going to take care of them anymore. They're your worry. And I see absolutely nobody coming and making any attempt whatsoever from the state to say, no, we really need to be responsible for these people till we can find a place for them where they can go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'm not familiar with our eviction notice statutes, but I do believe that this issue gets caught up in our FED statutes, and it might make sense is to bring someone who's knowledgeable about our eviction statutes, because I believe folks that house people rental-type services are required to give they have 30 days before they can actually kick someone out, and after they've made their last payment. And so I think, with all due respect to the department, I don't think it has anything to do with the department's actions. It's our eviction statutes that may address the situation you're talking about.
I understand, Senator Brown, but the thing of it is that I have dealt with for literally years and years and years, and it's been extremely frustrating. They'll hand down a rule, and you say, well, how in the world do I? Well, that's not my problem. Now we need some help. They automatically know there's a problem out there. They can't pay for something already. They shouldn't be able to just wash their hands. They ought to have to come on our side and go follow through the next step and say, we need to change this law over here to help us out, or we need to, if the emergency board does something, they need to tell the emergency board, look, we've got to work this out so we can at least buffer this or get these people in it. But they're not doing that. They just leave private and nonprofit and the senior people out there to just sink or swim. And it's not what I consider to be any way, shape, or form fair, because then they have to come around. These other people have to go back and get the legislature to move and fight to try to get a law changed or something like that on their own with no help from anybody else. And in reality, it's not their fault. You know, goodness sakes, the long-term care industry has been taking care of people for less than the cost for years and years and years, and then to just get bummed like this, and the poor folks that are left there that can no longer fend for themselves and don't have relatives and things like that, to just have a caseworker walk off the job and say, as of certain such a date, we no longer...
Right. Mr. Chair.
And I'm not saying that it is germane necessarily to this bill, but I'm going to take the prerogative of using this as a vehicle to put on record the frustration that some of us feel in trying to give reasonable good care and take care of our seniors as they ought to be taken care of and treat our folks as I believe people ought to be treated. And I am very willing to work on an amendment here and recognize that you do have problems and that I don't want the state to be responsible for paying things that they aren't responsible for either, or have them caught up in a situation where I would much sooner see them have an opportunity to work something into their workload rather than having to work overtime and all the things like that, because I recognize as an employer myself the problems that those things create.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, the department would certainly be more than happy to have additional discussions about how we could improve our relocation efforts for these folks.
I would certainly be willing to do that. And what I'm not sure at this point in time whether the -3 amendments actually answer the needs that you folks have. I'm thinking that there's still minus a couple of things that you need really to do logical decision making and notification practices in your overall program.
Chairman Fisher, I think as the -3 amendments as they are written, this works for us in terms of the individual notices. Since this does not affect those, that will continue. That's where the vast majority of our notices, our month-to-month notices, occur. And these amendments would not impact that. So that part's fine.
Does that allow you for, if somebody dumped something in your lap, in fact, you still have an opportunity under -3 to do that?
With less than 60 days, we would, the way this is worded, we would issue notices as soon as we possibly could, but we could do it no later than 10 days, is the way this is written now. But we would do it as soon as we possibly could. So if we could do it within 30 days, we would.
That 10 days for you is federal statute, right?
That's correct. But we can live with this as it is.
Then 30 days, as Amendment 1 would, -1 amendments would put in. How does that affect the -3 amendments?
Well, the -3 amendments bring us to the 30 days, incorporates the 30 days. The dash two, I'm not, Chairman Fisher, unfortunately, I didn't even see the dash two.
Dash 128, I think, isn't it?
No, the dash one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that dash one probably would have been 28. However, we haven't seen that, but hearing from Walker's office, I understand it's probably 28. The dash two merely addresses the 30 days. Dash three includes 30 days.
Oh,
and section
so
one, sub one,
so
30 days.
That makes dash one a superfluous.
Dash two is...
R2, yes.
Exactly.
Right. And one.
Yeah, and one,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, we believe dash three incorporates all of the concepts.
And I understand that the dash 3 would have a minor fiscal impact compared to, say, the dash 2, which would only change 20 to 30. Because, again, the dash 3 applies to benefit changes.
Yeah, that,
whereas
that's correct.
Dash 2 would apply to the whole
yes.
department.
That's correct. There would be very minor fiscal impact of this bill with dash 3.
Yeah. Looks like I lost all my cohorts here.
you don't have a committee any longer. You've got a subcommittee.
I have to give them 30 days notice. Oh.
Yeah.
This case will settle for 30 seconds. Huh?
I think it's pretty clear where we're going here. If we could get a committee, we'd move the bill, wouldn't we?
Yes, I'll put our subcommittee in recess here for a moment.
Excuse the witnesses if you're through with them.
Yes, I don't think we had any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much
thank
for
you.
Coming in.
Thank you.
I found two of them and they're on their way. So what I would suggest is maybe
I just recessed for a few moments. Senate Committee on Human Resources back to order, and we are going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 554 and open a work session on Senate Bill 554. And while you were out, we determined that the dash 3 amendments took care of the other two previous amendments, and were able to be handled by the department with relatively small expense.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, would you like a motion?
I would.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 554.
Senator Burdick moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 554. Is there any discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown? Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Florida? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morstead?
Aye.
And Senator
Fisher? Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Senate Bill 554 as amendment to the Senate, as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves that we send Senate Bill 554 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion or any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown? Senator
Clarno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries, and I will make a note that Senator Clarno has been excused to attend a funeral, and so she will not be here, and Senator Brown is excused for the moment. I believe Senator Walker would probably like to carry this bill, so I will make the determination that the bill is passed and Senator Walker will be the carrier. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 554 and open a work session on Senate Bill 119. Thank you folks for coming to testify for us. Staff, do you wish to kind of give us a little rundown on 119 here again?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 119 had its initial public hearing on the 10th of February. It creates procedures for use in civil actions to investigate physical or financial abuse of elderly or incapacitated persons. This bill currently has a subsequent referral to judiciary, and we do have a couple people in the audience who might be able to refresh your memory on more details of the bill, if you wish.
All right. I think I would call the folks from the Attorney General's office forward here. And, Tim, do you wish to come up with them, or would you sooner testify first?
No.
All right. We've got three chairs here, and I think we can keep this at arm's length so we don't need to defend ourselves too physically.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Department of Justice, assigned to the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. Just real quickly, what this bill does is it adds to the existing provisions of the Abuse of the Elderly, Disabled, and Incapacitated Act, the ability for the Attorney General or District Attorney to, in a civil investigation, issue what's called a civil investigative demand as a method of investigating allegations of abuse by a person, most notably when that person is not someone who is in the business of caring for elderly or incapacitated persons. It comes as a result of a number of cases that have been referred to our office where the subject of an allegation is a family member or an individual who is just taking care of a person, and we have no way of investigating those claims to make that determination about whether or not they have merit. What we've done is we've borrowed the investigative demand procedure that currently exists in the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and we've essentially imported it into this law to give us the ability to make that determination.
Ms. Pellegrini, I'm going to have to, we're in a subcommittee deal here, so I'm going to have to put us in recess till we can get another member. We have to have a quorum for a work session.
Okay.
And I haven't asked for a public hearing, so I can't go back into a public hearing for subcommittee purposes. So. Okay. work session here since we have a quorum. And go ahead, Ms. Pellegrini. And sorry for the interruption.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I think I said just about all I need to say by way of just encapsulating what the bill is about. If there's any questions, like I said, it's targeted to reach allegations where the target of the investigation is an individual as opposed to a business or a facility or anybody like that, or a professional guardian or conservator. Those are the cases we're trying to get. And it would be, for our purposes, Mr. Chair, I don't see this being used to investigate allegations of physical abuse. It's typically going to be allegations of financial abuse, like is a person taking care of their, you know, elderly relative and they're taking money out of the elderly relative's bank account and using it for personal gain as opposed to care of the relative. So it would be allegations like that.
Well, it's been my observation in the local actual working scene that we're much more apt to get somebody to respond to allegations of physical abuse than you are of financial abuse.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. If for no other reason than if the allegation is physical abuse, there are other agencies that will become involved, and typically the district attorney's office may become involved because it may involve allegations of the criminal offense of mistreatment or something like that.
But we have had several instances of people that have suggested, and again, I have no investigative power, so I can't go back and say that, but they bring allegations of somebody being taken advantage of by someone that moved in to, quote, help them and winds up with new cars and all of this kind of stuff. And then they have, and there's very little. A person may not be either mentally or capable or... either that or they don't want to face the issue and so they don't speak up for themselves. And so I can understand the need for something there that would maybe help out in this. Tim, you had some, I think, comments concerning the privacy acts and things like that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. And I would just, add that, this bill does come from the Attorney General's Task Force on Elder Abuse, which we do have a banking representative on. Unfortunately, one of the things, and we're not opposed to the bill. I want to make very clear to that. We do think, though, it does need amendment. There is, under ORS 192550, special rules that financial institutions face in releasing customer financial records, as you can imagine, or
still
information.
I should send Senator Brown away back
then. No. Please don't leave. I'll be brief. Anyway, there is statutes that does prevent or require certain things to happen in order for financial institutions to release records or information to state and local government agencies. We believe this bill needs to be amended to include provisions that allow financial institutions to release these records, and that's all we're after. And I don't believe that the Attorney General has any difficulty with that, and it's the committee's choice whether you do that here or in a different committee in this building.
Yeah. Okay. And I had some questions kind of along that, too, because then, and I think probably that it would maybe catch you on the medical records side of things and some of the privacy restrictions and stuff. I don't know whether that would... Do you know whether those type of things would...
Mr. Chair, are you thinking of HIPAA requirements? I don't think that in the course of an investigation into the financial abuse of an elderly person, we'd necessarily need substantive medical records. What we may need are billing records to a provider to see whether or not payments that should have been made were in fact made on behalf of the elderly person.
And perhaps how they were made.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just add, if I may, Tim Martinez again. This time I'll put on my Oregon Medical Association hat because I am dealing with the DMV on at-risk drivers, and we've looked at this HIPAA issue. And when it is a request from local government agencies, HIPAA doesn't apply. And I can actually get you a letter from the AG's office that lays that out.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question for Mr. Martinez. Tim, given the deadline to hear Senate bills is quickly approaching April 11th and the date to pass them out of the Senate is a week later, would it be possible to get the amendment drafted, assuming it fits within the relating clause, as the bill moves over to the Judiciary Committee, as this bill has a subsequent referral on it? You want to rescind that?
I would just send rescind it and
okay.
send it right to
All
the floor.
Right. That's fine. Great.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I'm not sure which hat I have on, but absolutely we would certainly do it as quickly as we could.
Yes, yeah. You are getting
Again, I think the AG's office, Cheryl, has agreed that she will is willing to make those changes. So where they occur is not as important the fact that they do occur.
Does this also, would it give the investigative demand, the proposed investigative demand, grant the AG or DA additional authority to bypass the provisions of ORS 124.115? And I've got one of those books here if you would need them.
I may, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have a copy of the entire statute in my file. It wouldn't, Mr. Chair, it wouldn't change the provisions of 124.115 at all.
Okay. Well, and I think that basically, if I don't hear anything other than from the committee, that we will ask to rescind the referral to judicial and ask you to go ahead with the amendment and work together with the AG's office. And just as soon as you can get that done, we'll bring this right back and ask.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
That concludes our work for the day. Thank you, staff and committee members, and we're adjourned.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Wow.
Good.